Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org. Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, offering online bachelor completion programs, including business, education, nursing, and more. Information is available at viterbo.edu/completion.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Trump administration says it's hopeful that Congress will pass the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal this fall, but Democrats and labor unions say not so fast. We'll get two Wisconsin takes on that deal coming up. Now, the number of severe storms in northwestern Wisconsin seems to be growing and getting more intense along the way, dumping a lot of rain on the region. That's caused problems in the last few years for a lot of the region's local communities who are trying to rebuild damaged infrastructure to deal with more rain, also trying to work within the limitations of their budgets. Our partners at WisContext recently spent some time in the area looking at how places are coping with these changes. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. His latest piece at WisContext.org is titled Washed Away, Northwest Wisconsin Copes with the Costs of a Changing Climate. Will, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, remind us of the storms we've seen just over the last handful of years in this part of the state.
Sure. There was a really pretty intense storm in 2012 that affected northeastern Minnesota a little bit more than Wisconsin. But that storm really affected Douglas County and especially the city of Superior and also some parts of Bayfield County. And then there was a really bad storm in July 2016 that affected a wide swath of northwestern Wisconsin from the Minnesota border all the way to the border of the UP. That dumped up to 10 inches of rain in a lot of places. The Bad River, which drains into Lake Superior, reached peak stream flows in 15 hours, stream flows that were like almost twice as high as the previous record. And then there was another flood in 2018 that hit a lot of the same places that were hit in 2016.
And each of these did quite a bit of damage, right, to the extent that it's not all fixed yet.
Yes, quite a lot of damage, especially to road infrastructure. Washed out roads as a result of failed culverts pretty often.
We hear phrases sometimes like 100-year flood, 500-year flood, 1,000-year flood. We don't need to dig exactly into the probability here, but 100-year flood doesn't mean if it happened this year, it's not going to happen again for a century.
Yeah, it can be confusing. Those terms are kind of confusing, especially when each of those floods in 2012, 2016, and 2018 were variously, in some places, considered a 100 or a 500 or even a 1,000-year flood. So that doesn't mean that those storms are only expected to recur every 100 or 500 or 1,000 years. It just means that the probability, for instance, of a 100-year storm hitting in any given location in a single year is 1%. So that means that it could hit 2 years in a row.
Now, a big point, a big piece of the story you wrote, and we'll be talking about this more with our next guest, is the infrastructure in place, culverts, road preparedness, a lot of other things not ready for this kind of intensity of rainfall.
Right. The local governments are responsible for maintaining roads, especially counties and the townships. And for decades, they've been following precipitation guidelines. They usually build roads to kind of a 100-year flood standard. And they've been following guidelines that seem to be pretty out of date. And some townships also haven't even been hitting those guidelines, basically because of cost. Culverts can be pretty expensive once they get bigger. Recently it was found out that, for instance, in Ashland, the amount of precipitation that's expected in a quote-unquote 100-year storm is actually about 35% greater than was previously understood. So even the townships that were installing culverts that were quote-unquote properly sized for a 100-year storm in the region weren't actually prepared for what was possible.
Talking to Will Cushman from WisContext about his piece on flooding in northern Wisconsin, recent floods over the last few years, and communities trying to prepare for the next one. As part of that, Will, okay, we have culverts being overrun, destroyed. Communities want to build them more in line with the flooding that they're worried about. What happens when they go to FEMA for funding to do that?
Right. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? If a culvert fails, and destroys a road because there was too much rainwater flowing through it and backing up, you'd want to build a larger culvert. That makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, when a local community gets FEMA funding, often what FEMA requires is that they rebuild that infrastructure in kind, meaning that they have to rebuild it as it was prior to the disaster. And when the infrastructure is inadequate for the rainstorms that have been hitting the region, rebuilding it as it was before just is pretty impractical, but that is often the decision that communities have to face. Either go it alone, and a lot of them don't. Most townships and counties are struggling with funding, especially for roads, or go to FEMA and have to follow their rules and rebuild in kind.
You talked to local officials in the northwestern Wisconsin region. Did you get a sense of frustration with that? That one piece of the puzzle.
Very much so. I think people did acknowledge the help. I mean, FEMA has been tremendously helpful in a lot of ways in helping fund rebuilding of infrastructure. But yes, definitely talk to chairs of townships and county highway commissioners who have been pretty frustrated by the FEMA rules. Some of the more tenacious ones have been able to negotiate with FEMA to allow some upgrades to infrastructures, install some larger culverts that can handle more stormwater. But really, it's difficult to get that go-ahead from FEMA and really requires a lot of back-and-forth negotiation.
Let's look at the role of climate change. I know you can't generally look at one storm and say this was a climate change storm, but
right.
Is it the sense when you talk to experts on this that it's loading the dice a little bit? It's making the freak event a bit less freaky over time.
Yeah. What's expected in the region with climate change and in the upper Midwest generally is more frequent, intense, extreme precipitation, kind of like the events that that northwestern Wisconsin has seen in 2012, 2016, and 2018. So communities are fully expecting for events like this to recur in the future, for sure.
So what sense do you get from local officials up there as they trust? They're still trying to clean up from the past. They're trying to plan for this future where these storms are going to be more likely, probably. And as you said, they're not carrying around bags of money adequate to deal with this. Talk about the position they're in.
Yeah, some of them kind of described feeling a sense of almost like PTSD when there's a big – like a thunderstorm in the forecast, kind of this sense of impending potential doom, like just knowing that the majority or a good portion of the infrastructure, even the infrastructure that's been rebuilt, could potentially not withstand another storm like they've seen in the last few years. So I think there's really a sense of anxiety in some of these communities. But I think in some places also some optimism that they have been able to upgrade enough culverts or maybe strategically upgrade some stream crossings, road crossings to make the region at least a little bit more resilient to these major storms.
As we wrap up, we'll talk to somebody who's been studying this in just a few minutes, but do you see efforts at the state level or federal level to help these local communities boost what you just said, their resilience in the face of flooding?
Yeah, especially I think at the federal level right now, there is a bill in the U.S. Senate co-sponsored by Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin that would require the Department of Transportation to consider resilience in disaster grants. So this would be like the Federal Highway Administration. So to consider the resilience in improving resilience in a project that's funded by those grant monies. Not sure how that would affect how FEMA goes about what it does after a disaster, but there is at least talk at the federal level of being a little bit more practical about how we rebuild after a disaster.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Will Cushman, Associate Editor of WisContext. Coming up next, we'll hear from one of the first environmental scientists in northwestern Wisconsin to raise concerns about how prepared the region was for more intense flooding. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived through one or two or three of these massive storms and the flooding that they brought? If you live in an area where flooding is a risk, in northwestern Wisconsin or other parts of the state, is your community ready for these kind of storms in the future? What do you want to see yourself do to get more prepared? We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about how northwestern Wisconsin is responding to the growing frequency and intensity of storms and the flooding that often follows. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is you and your life, you've seen these floods and storms close up. What was it like dealing with the damage to local roads and bridges? Do you have experience working with FEMA? What questions do you have about ways your community can get better prepared for future storms? Are you in local government in a community that's been hit by flooding? Love to hear your perspective. Call 800-642-1234. Randy Lair joins us now, former environmental scientist at Northland College in Ashland. He's now dean of math and science at Sierra College in California. Randy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, back in 2014, Randy, you said the Shawamigan Bay was arguably the, and I'm quoting here, least climate-adapted spot in the country from an infrastructure standpoint. What did you mean by that?
Well, when I made that comment, we were looking at some of these historical rainfalls. And so the National Weather Service for a long time had produced a data set that gave information to engineers to get a sense of how big they should build culverts and bridges at different road crossings. Every time a road crosses a stream, they want to know how much rain falls on the land upstream so they can get a sense of how big the culvert needs to be or how big the bridge needs to be. And it turned out that the data they were using back in the 1960s wasn't matching up with some of the things that they were seeing on the ground. And so NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, started to update these data. And when they did that, they found out that there were some places where the new estimates were wildly different than the old numbers that were out there. And one of those places was Shawamigan Bay. And so the communities throughout the Shawamigan Bay area, the new numbers were saying that it was raining somewhere between, you know, maybe 20% to 45% more now than it used to be. And so what had been happening was, you know, engineers had been designing and building road crossings with these old data for a really long time. And it turns out that after we looked at things a little more finely, they were undersized and so prone to this kind of washout. And if you look at those differences, the 35 and 45% differences, those stood out across the country that had been studied at the time as some of the greatest differences. And so that was what prompted me to make that statement.
We got a call from Robert in Winchester, broadening the perspective here a little bit. He wanted to ask about the impact of deforestation in northern Wisconsin and how that affects flooding and lake levels. And I understand, Randy, that changes in forests and wetlands are part of the story here.
Yeah, definitely. So there's kind of two parts to the equation, you know, how much rain is coming down and then how much of that rain actually makes its way into the streams. And so there are different parts of the state that had been clear-cut significantly in the turn of the century. And what you see is that if you change the vegetation, a higher percentage of the rainfall ends up running off. So some of these historical land practices had kind of predisposed the landscape to be a little bit more flood prone than it would have been otherwise. So you combine that with more intense rainfalls and undersized infrastructure, and you kind of have a few different factors converging there.
You mentioned runoff, and a lot of people focus, understandably, on, you know, the washed out roads, the washed out houses, things like that. This all ends up ultimately in Lake Superior, right? Can you talk about what happens after these larger than expected floods and runoff in the lake itself?
Yeah, it's really quite striking if you're ever up in the area after one of these big rainstorms. Basically, the whole near shore area, so the waters right next to the shoreline of Lake Superior, turn this kind of vivid red color that's all the clay that has washed off the land and gotten into the lake. And so the clarity of the lake is usually, you can see down 30, 40 feet in some cases. And when it gets really murky, you can only see down a couple of inches. You put your hand in the water and you can't see it anymore. And, you know, there's all sorts of other ramifications, different pollutants washing into the water. But we start to see that having impacts on water quality in Lake Superior, effects on fisheries, and so on.
One piece you wrote raised a couple of what ifs. There was a proposed big iron mine in the region and more recently a proposed large-scale animal farm in the region. Those weren't there for the flooding. What kind of worries would you have for projects like those if they were there?
Yeah, well, I think that was one of the big what-if questions that we were wrestling with. And so these large-scale development projects are guided in how they have to deal with rainfall and stormwater by different parts of the administrative code. And the administrative code in Wisconsin really hasn't been thoroughly updated to reflect our new understanding of rainfall intensity. So had those two large-scale developments been built, they would have been required by law to use data that were already outdated to design manure storage or mine tailing waste ponds to treat water quality or to improve water quality. And it's a big what-if scenario, but the question that presents itself is, had these facilities been built with outdated standards and we would have gotten these big rainstorms on top of them, what would have happened? You know, would the facilities have held, or would the manure ponds and mine tailing ponds have washed out, just like we saw much of the other undersized infrastructure wash out? And I think there were a very tenuous public debate around these different facilities, and it sort of intersects with a lot of these changing precipitation patterns and undersized infrastructure.
Talking to Randy Lair, formerly from Northland College in Ashland, now with Sierra College in California, talking about flooding in Wisconsin, northwestern Wisconsin in particular, as a case study. Bigger rains, more of them, overwhelming local communities' infrastructure meant to deal with now outdated predictions of what a big rainfall could be. Randy, has this series of storms, you think, been a wake-up call? Does this have people actually trying to fix this thing before the next big storm?
Definitely. I think the local governments are really keyed in on this and doing what they can to update facilities and try to prepare and prevent the impacts of other such storms into the future. But as your last guest was talking about, there are some limitations in the way that FEMA funds can be used to replace washed out road crossings. Most of these communities are in very rural areas, and so they just don't have a lot of funding to go in and preemptively upgrade or increase the size of road crossings. So I think they're keyed in at the local level and doing everything they can. One of the areas that things have lagged behind a little bit that I alluded to is we really haven't updated our administrative code throughout the state. Other states throughout the region, Minnesota, for example, took these new rainfall estimates and, 7-8 years ago now, updated the requirements for engineering design and construction projects to incorporate our new understanding or updated understanding of rainfall. And Wisconsin just hasn't done that in a thorough way at this point in time. So we're a little bit behind the curve there, I would say.
Are there more or less universal lessons that local governments, local communities can take to say, yeah, we want to be more flood resilient given this changing storm landscape?
Yeah, I think there's two different ways to approach that. You know, one of the ways that FEMA funds can be accessible to upgrade, say you a small culvert washed out and you wanted to replace it with a larger culvert. If you do the design work ahead of time and you know based on some scientific assessment that, yep, the culvert that's in there right now is too small, when we replace it, we should replace it with a larger one. If those types of studies have been done ahead of time, FEMA has a mitigation process where they allow you to put in a larger culvert, but doing that sort of in the heat of the moment after you've had a large-scale disaster in a county is really difficult. And so the more that type of planning can be done on the front end, the easier it is to use some of these federal dollars to upgrade infrastructure. The other thing that the region is doing quite a lot of is on-the-ground projects to try to slow the flow of water across the landscape is sort of the lingo that people use. And that's doing things like putting in rain gardens or constructed wetlands or things like that to trap more of the runoff or slow it down before it gets into the stream. So if there's less water that comes, that gets into a stream after a big rainstorm, then the size of the infrastructure you need to build can be proportionally less. And there's a lot of attention being paid to that in the South Shore of Lake Superior right now.
Okay, are we counting on this county government and this small city and this township and so this village to each come up with their own solutions? Or are you seeing, or do we need more coordinated efforts from at the state level or federal level?
I think it's going to take cooperation across all levels. I think most of this is being driven by the local level governments right now. They're the ones that are having to deal with this most intimately. But we're starting to see some traction at both the state and federal level. But I think really to get the ball across the goal line, it's going to take sort of a large scale cooperative effort.
Northwestern Wisconsin isn't the only part of the state or the region, obviously, to feel the effects of flooding. Do you think that places that haven't seen big flooding yet are taking this seriously, or does it take having that overwhelming flood to get local leaders to get on board with doing something here?
Yeah, that certainly increases people's attention to the concerns. But other places have looked at other modifications. So a number of years ago, the Greater Chicago area actually went through and developed their own rainfall data to guide their infrastructure development. So they had kind of been seeing changes in precipitation patterns and, you know, undertook a region-wide study to figure out, well, how should we be designing our infrastructure? So we have seen some very progressive approaches to that, but definitely, when you see the disaster, that really gets people's attention, unfortunately.
I talked to Will Cushman earlier a little bit about how climate change plays into all of this. What do you see as when it comes to climate change and a risk of flooding?
Yeah. I mean, like you had talked about earlier, you can't really ever attribute one storm to climate change. It's more the trend, more the trajectory. But one of the interesting and maybe disturbing things about the region is that in most cases in northern Wisconsin over the last 50 years, the state had actually been in pretty significant drought, with the exception of the Shawangan Bay area. The amount and the intensity of precipitation had actually been increasing over the last 50 plus years, while the rest of northern Wisconsin was actually drier and drier. And so there's a lot of questions about, will that continue to increase into the future? And sort of our region-wide studies suggest that it will. The degree to which that happens and the timing over which that happens is a little unclear, but the trends seem like they're all lining up.
Well, and the fear is that we're going to see more extremes, so we might see unusually long droughts and then unusually intense rainfalls. We could see them going back and forth.
Exactly. That's the concern, is that you'd have, intermittent periods of drought and flooding, which is sort of both extremes. Neither one of them is particularly good.
If you were consulted by state lawmakers, Randy, what would you tell them should be their top priority when it comes to getting ready for these more intense storms?
I think the easiest thing, the first thing to do, is to look at the administrative code to make sure that the required design standards are meeting or are aligned with our newest understanding of rainfall patterns. They're just not right now. And the other thing, I think, is to look at some of these cooperative efforts. There's been some work at the federal level now to introduce some bills to try to look at resiliency and to look at ways in which the federal and state efforts can be aligned to accelerate some of this adaptation and resiliency planning.
Randy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Randy Lair, formerly with Northland College in Ashland, now Dean of Math and Science at Sierra College in California. He's with us today to talk about how local communities can plan for better infrastructure in light of heavier storms, especially recently in northwestern Wisconsin. If you want to hear more about WisContext reporting on the impact of flooding in northwestern Wisconsin, tune into Here and Now tomorrow night at 7:30 or 11:30 on Wisconsin Public Television, or read about it online at wiscontext.org.